White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
And good evening, listeners and fans of the International Jew. Tonight is August 23rd, 2012. We're reading Chapter 7. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and I'm here with Hadding Scott, as per usual. Hi, Hadding. You always say hello before I say hello to you. So there we go. Now we're all set. We don't need any more introduction that I know of. Do you know of any more that we need?
No. Here we are.
Okay. Well, I think this is a very interesting chapter. I really got a lot out of it. And I did a little study about it, had some time to do that, and then so that got me even more out of it. So I'm looking forward to it. I think this particular chapter's got me so anti-Jewish that I can hardly contain myself.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, I'm probably not supposed to sound that way, but I mean, what it brings out is it's just kind of sickening, and it makes me sick. I get sick of it. Anyway, we're going to learn about it. We're going to find out. And so, what is the title?
The title is, scroll down for that.
Oh, I've got it right here.
Arthur Brisbane leaps to the help of Jewry.
Yeah, all right. Well, just like what they do now, they were doing back then. And it's really amazing how powerfully these people worked for Jewish interests. Arthur Brisbane was certainly no Jew. So why don't you just go ahead and get started?
Yeah, starts off with, actually I'm starting to doubt this a little bit. It's an alleged quote from Baron Moses Montefiore, who was a financier, a banker, and the sheriff of London, a donor to Zionist causes, and president of the Board of Deputies of British Jews, and he lived 1784 to 1885. It says, "What are you prating about? As long as we do not have the press of the whole world in our hands, everything you may do is vain. We must control or influence the papers of the whole world in order to blind and deceive the people."
Well, yeah, when would he have said that?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds like it's too self-accusatory to be anything that he would have said in public, obviously.
And, you know, I mean, they don't put here where it was said or anything like that. Just has his name here. So that is kind of questionable, but they must have believed it. I don't think they would put in things that they didn't. So maybe it's something that came to their attention, but it's not very well sourced, so...
No, there's no source given.
No, none. None at all.
So,
well, it sounds like the protocols is what it sounds like.
It's a big question mark. Yeah, it does sound like that, although it doesn't say that it's... He didn't live... Montefiore didn't live long enough to be an alleged participant at that Zionist conference.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, unless somebody in that work of fiction is presented as quoting him, I don't know what the source for this could
be. Yeah, you know, I mean, he's a high-level British personage with the title and all, even though he's Jewish. He's supposed to be this great philanthropist.
Meaning that he gave money to other Jews.
Yes, it was all for Jews. It was all for the good of Jews all around the world. But why would he be saying something like this? Maybe he said it in private, but they're not telling us, so this is not very, very good. I would be better without this.
Yeah, actually, if you're going to present something that looks questionable on its face, you got to have a source.
Right. Before you even start, I'll go ahead and just mention that Arthur Brisbane, the subject of this chapter, is Well, his dates are 1864 to 1936. So this what he wrote in 1920, what's being referred to here, and that was 16 years before his death. So he was still functioning and working and so on. And he's one of the best-known American newspaper editors of the 20th century. He became editor of the New York Journal under William Randolph Hearst and was one of Hearst's close friends. His syndicated editorial column had an estimated daily readership of over 20 million. Yeah, syndicated, like he was editor of the New York Journal, but his editorial that he wrote every day, I guess, or whenever he wrote it, would go out to a lot of other newspapers, not the Hearst newspapers, and yep. Then others, too, would pick it up. But first it'd go to the Hearst newspapers, I suppose, at the same time, because in this Canadian Jewish Chronicle that I'm going to mention, they said that they took it from the New York American, which was a Hearst paper. So that was, you know, Hearst had a lot of papers. Anyway, he was a famous man. He was a very influential man. And for some reason, we're going to find out, well, we don't really know the reason, but that he decided to write this particular article about the Jews. So,
well, there are many possible reasons.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, okay. We can give those after we get started reading.
Yeah. Well, it's in the course of the article.
Oh.
All right. So, Arthur Brisbane leaps to the help of Jewry. Once more, the current of this series on the modern Jewish question is interrupted to give notice of the appearance of the question in another quarter. The appearance this time consisting of a more than two-column Today editorial in the Hearst papers of Sunday, June 20th, from the pen of Arthur Brisbane. It would be too much to say that Mr. Brisbane is the most influential writer in the country, but perhaps he is among the dozen most widely read. It is therefore a confirmation of the statement that the question is assuming importance in this country, that a writer of Mr. Brisbane's prominence should openly discuss it.
Okay, now I want to throw in here, because I don't think anywhere in this chapter by Ford, do they give the title of this article of Brisbane's? Because at that time, I guess everybody was just supposed to know it. You know, it was so well known. But it was titled Facts, : An Antidote to Prejudice. That was the title of Brisbane's editorial.
Yeah.
And also, it was came out on Sunday, June 20th, as you said, and this chapter appeared in the Dearborn Independent on July 3rd, you know, about 2 weeks later. Okay.
Of course, Mr. Brisbane has not studied the question. He would probably admit in private conversation, though such an admission would hardly be in harmony with the tone of certainty he publicly adopts, that he really knows nothing about it. He knows, however, as a good newspaper man, how to handle it when the exigencies of the newspaper day throw it up to him for offhand treatment. Every editorial writer knows how to do that. There is something good in every race, or there have been some notable individuals in it, or it has played a picturesque part in history. That is enough for a very readable editorial upon any class of people who may happen to be represented in the community. The question, whatever it may be, need not be studied at all. A certain group of people may be salved for a few paragraphs, and the job need never be tackled again. Every newspaper man knows that.
Yeah, and you know, when he says the question, when they write the question, they always capitalize the word question, because they're talking about a, you know, always talking about
the Jewish question.
Yeah, right.
And yet, having lived in New York for a long time, having had financial dealings of a large and obligating nature with certain interests in this country, having seen, no doubt, more or less of the inner workings of the great trust and banking groups, and being constantly surrounded by assistants and advisors who are members of the Jewish race, Mr. Brisbane must have had his thoughts. It is, however, no part of a newspaper man's business to expose his thoughts about the racial groups of his community. Say more, or any more than it is a showman's business to express his opinion of the patrons of his show. The kinds of offense a newspaper will give, and the occasions on which it will feel justified in giving it, are very limited.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, newspapers, one thing they don't want to do is offend any particular group.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's out.
So, assuming that Mr. Brisbane had to write at all, it could have been told beforehand what he would write. The only wonder is that he felt he had to write. Did he really feel that the Jews are being persecuted when an attempt is made to uncover the extent and causes of their control in the United States and elsewhere? Did he feel, with good editorial shrewdness, that here was an opportunity to win the attention and regard of the most influential group in New York and the nation? Or, and this seems within the probabilities, was he inclined simply to pass it over until secretarial suggestions reached him for a Sunday editorial, or until some of the bondholders made their wishes known? This is not at all to impugn Mr. Brisbane's motives, but merely to indicate on what slender strings such an editorial may depend. But what is more important? Does Mr. Brisbane consider that, having disposed of the Sunday editorial, he is through with the question, or that the question itself is solved? That is the worst of daily editorializing. Having come safely and inoffensively through with one editorial, the matter is at an end as far as that particular writer is concerned. That is, as a usual thing. It is to be hoped that Mr. Brisbane is not through. He ought not to leave a big question without contributing something to it, and in his Sunday editorial he did not contribute anything. He even made mistakes, which he ought to correct for further study. What about the Phoenicians? He asks. He should have looked that up while his mind was opened receptively toward the subject, and he would not have made so miserable a blunder as to connect them so closely with the Jews. He would never find a Jew doing that.
Yeah, he called, by the way, he called the Phoenicians Semites. And then he talked about them as though all the great things that they did were done by the Jews, were done by Jews, that we should give Jews credit for it. Yeah, all this seafaring and shipbuilding and so on. Yeah.
That's kind of playing with the word anti-Semitism in a way. I mean, everybody knows anti-Semitism means only anti-Jewish, the position being anti-Jewish, because, you know, Arabs are accused of being anti-Semitic. How does that make any sense?
True. Well, people bring that up every so often, but it doesn't make any impact because the words that we use are chosen by the controllers of the media, who are the Jews. So, you know, we just sort of find ourselves continually being forced to use these words.
There's actually quite a range of racial types among people that are characterized as Semitic, which really just means that they spoke a Semitic language. I was in the Louvre some time ago, and I went through the Near East section, and I saw busts of Phoenicians, ancient Phoenicians, and they didn't look any different than Greeks. Whereas you look at some of the other busts, like from Palmyra, which is another Semitic culture, and they look very strange.
Hmm. So well, I never looked at
it's really a linguistic group, not a racial group per se.
Yes.
At least in modern times. Okay, he would never find a Jew doing that. It is permissible, however, in Jewish propaganda intended for Gentile consumption. The Phoenicians themselves certainly never thought they were connected in any way with the Jews. And the Jews were equally without light on the subject. If in nothing else, they differed in their attitude toward the sea. The Phoenicians not only built boats, but manned them. The Jew would rather risk his investment in a boat than himself. In everything else, the differences between the two peoples were deep and distinct. Mr. Brisbane should have turned up the Jewish Encyclopedia at that point in his dictation. It is to be hoped he will resume his study, and when he has found something that is not printed in simply written Jewish books, will give the world the benefit of it.
Now, you see, that's simply written, because I read you that line from, it was either from the article by Brisbane or from that little editorial at the beginning of that Canadian Jewish paper, and they talked about simply written. I think it was Brisbane who recommended to, that's it, Brisbane recommended to Ford in the beginning of his editorial that he should consult some simply written Jewish books. And so this is the Ford getting back at getting, you know, a little dig there. About what, how much knowledge each one has about Jews.
He's kind of calling him stupid by saying, here's a very simple book for you. You could understand this.
Yeah.
All right. It is hardly like the question of the rotundity of the earth. This question is not settled, and it will be discussed. Mr. Brisbane is in a position to pursue some investigations of his own on this subject. He has a large staff, and it is presumed that some of its members are Gentiles of unbiased minds. He has a worldwide organization. Since his own modification of speech and views following upon his adventure in the money-making world, he has a look in upon certain groups of men and certain tendencies of power. Why does he not take this question as a world problem and go after the facts and the solution? Says that he modified his speech and his views after he became acquainted with the people in the money-making world. This guy's kind of a phony.
Brisbane.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's really going after Ford, you know, and he... oh, what am I talking about here? Who's... Okay, all right. This is Ford. This is Ford talking about Brisbane having a large staff. I got myself thinking about that article that Brisbane wrote, and I'm still thinking about it. So, all right, so he's saying that that Brisbane modified his speech.
Yeah.
Views, following upon once he wanted to start making money. Oh, that's pretty strong language, isn't it?
Yeah.
Sorry, confused that.
It is a task worthy of any newspaper organization. It will assist America to make the contribution which she must make if this question is ever to be turned from the bugbear it has been through all the centuries. All the talk on earth about loving our fellow men will not serve in lieu of an investigation, because it is asking men to love those who are rapidly and insidiously gaining the mastery of them.
That's really good, isn't it?
Yeah. What's wrong with the Jew is the first question, and then what's wrong with the Gentile to make it possible? I didn't say that in the right tone. What's wrong with the Jew is the first question, and then what's wrong with the Gentile to make it possible?
Well, so there again, you know, even here, blaming the Gentiles.
Well, see, this is actually the question that Ford's asking. These are his questions. You know, his questions
well,
he's suggesting
true.
For Arthur Brisbane. In other words, why don't we see what the Jews are doing? Why are we letting them get away with it?
Yeah, it's true. But then, you know, we find this even in Ford. And in that time where it comes back to, well, if we're letting the Jews get away with this, there's truth in that. But again, there's something wrong with us. Well, the best of our people were not able to prevent the Jews from doing what they're doing. And it's very, very difficult. The best thing to do is what I came to the conclusion after this chapter, even more than ever, is that we cannot coexist with the Jew. I mean, I said that last week, now even more so this week. By the time we get to chapter 40, I'll be really going on it. But, we're not the first cause. They're the first cause of the problem.
Well, actually, European society used to have a lot more resistance to Jewish penetration than it has today.
Well, that was Christian.
Well, it's not just Christian. I think it has more to do with the growth of liberalism in the West. I mean, liberalism in the proper sense of the word, treating people as individuals with individual rights rather than looking after the good of the society as a whole. It used to be community, and the good of the community was put first. When you throw that out in favor of individual rights, which is something that happened during the Enlightenment because some people had made a lot of money at that point in history through trade with colonies, and they wanted more power.
Mm-hmm.
The result of that is that Jews are able to get an inroad.
Well, you're right. You're absolutely right about that.
When you have a bunch of individuals pursuing individual interests, and among them a group, a cohesive group moves in that cooperates and conspires to gain as much power as it can for itself, all those scattered individuals don't have a chance.
Okay, so what's wrong with the Gentile to make it possible is this rise in individualism, individualistic thinking.
Which can be
personified today by, in large measure, by libertarianism.
Well, yes, but the whole society is really like that. USA was founded on that idea.
Yes. But libertarians take it to a further degree almost.
That's true. I mean,
people used to be aware of that.
Whole idea of individualism used to be not as extreme as it is now in the United States. Libertarianism only started in the 60s.
And it was started by Jews, too.
I'm not sure about that.
Well, I'm not either. But, I mean, it has attracted a lot of Jews. There's a lot of well-known Jews who have studied it. Well, Ayn Rand, she didn't start libertarianism.
Yeah. Well, Ayn Rand, certainly influential. Ron Paul named his son Rand.
Yeah. Was that after him? After her, I guess, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I guess I knew that.
Yeah.
Well, let's go on.
As in the case of every Gentile writer who appears as the Jew's good-natured defender, Mr. Brisbane is compelled to state a number of facts which comprise a part of the very question whose existence is denied. Every other successful name you see in a great city is a Jewish name, says Mr. Brisbane. In his own city, the ratio is even higher than that. Jews numbering less than 1% of the earth's population possessed by conquest, enterprise, industry, and intelligence. 50% of the world's commercial success, says Mr. Brisbane.
Yep, he's a real bootlicker.
Does it mean anything to Mr. Brisbane? Has he ever thought how it will all turn out? Is he willing to absolve that success from every quality which humanity has a right to challenge? Is he entirely satisfied with the way that success is used where it is supreme? would he be willing to undertake to prove that it is due to those commendable qualities he has named and nothing less commendable?
That's where it's at, right there. But he goes on about that.
Speaking of the Jew-financed Harriman Railroad campaign, is Mr. Brisbane ready to write his endorsement upon that? Did he ever hear of Jewish money backing railroads that were built for railroad purposes and nothing else?
Yeah, well, you want to say a few, little bit about that, just real quick?
I mean, I'm not entirely sure. I know that there was
other purposes than just the railroads for the good of the country.
But, well, there's a big history of crookedness involving railroads in the United States. Bankers would always be on the boards of directors of railroads, and the bankers could make as much money by having the railroad fail as having it succeed.
Well, there you go.
But I'm not sure if that's what he's getting at here.
Well, it's things like that, you know, things that, you know, they were all making lots of other money. They weren't building railroads just because, you know, they were these, you know, great men who created railroads for the nation. They were getting so much else out of it, and who at whose expense, you know, at other people's expense.
Also, there are government subsidies. There can be government subsidies involved in building railroads.
That's true.
There was a big scandal around the time of the war between the states with, I think it was called Crédit Mobilier or American Credit Mobilier, that it got, because of the war going on, the government wasn't really doing good oversight. And this railroad company, which was attached to a bank, was building all these, had a government subsidy to build railroad, rail line, and it got paid by the mile. And so they would make a lot of loops and such to have as many miles of track as possible.
Crooked. Just goes on and on and on. This kind of stuff. Never ends.
It would be very easy to suggest to Mr. Brisbane, as editor, a series of articles which would be most enlightening, both to himself and his readers, if he would only put unbiased men at work gathering the facts for them.
Mm-hmm.
One of the articles might be entitled, The Jews at the Peace Conference.
Well, I'll just throw in here, I was checking this out, and of course he's talking about the Paris Peace Conference of 1919, which is just the year before, held at Versailles, the one we all know about, where the Versailles Treaty was formed. And there was more than the Versailles Treaty at the Paris Peace Conference. They also came up with the Treaty of Saint-Germain for Austria, the Treaty of Neuilly, it's probably not pronounced right, for Bulgaria, the Treaty of Trianon for Hungary, and the Treaty of Sèvres for, and subsequently revised to the Treaty of Lausanne, for the Ottoman Empire. So, this was a big, big deal. And what he says about it, everybody should pay a lot of attention to this. This is, I think, one of the things that made me so mad.
Okay. Brisbane's men should be instructed to learn who were the most prominent figures at the peace conference. Who came and went most constantly and most busily. Who were given freest access to the most important persons and chambers. Which race provided the bulk of the private secretaries to the important personages there? Which race provided most of the sentinels through whom engagements had to be made with men of note? Which race went furthest in the endeavor to turn the whole proceeding into a festival rout by dances and lavish entertainment? Which civilians of prominence oftenest dined the leading conferees in private session?
There you go. He doesn't answer it, but, you know, we can answer that ourselves.
Well, you can imagine, certainly.
Yeah, real easy.
If Mr. Brisbane, with the genius for reporting which his organization deservedly has, will turn his men loose on that assignment and then print what they bring him. He will have a story that will make a mark even in his remarkable career as an editor. He might even run a second story on the Peace Conference titled, Which Program Won at the Peace Conference? He might instruct his men to inquire as to the business which brought the Jews in such quality and quantity to Paris, and how it was put through. Particularly should they inquire whether any jot or tittle of the Jews' world program was refused or modified by the Peace Conference. It should also be carefully inquired whether, after getting what they went after, they did not then ask for still more and get that, too, even though it constituted a discrimination against the rest of the world. Mr. Brisbane would doubtless be surprised to learn that of all the programs submitted to that conference, not accepting the great program on which humanity hung so many pathetic hopes, the only program to go through was the Jews program. And yet, he could learn just that if he inquired. The question is, having obtained that information, what would Mr. Brisbane do with it?
Well, they seem to be very certain that the Jews were in control at the Paris Peace Conference, and that it's their program that went through. Now, they might be more overly, they might have more, hold on, can't even come, they might have more confidence in that than they should, but I don't know. But they're obviously very confident about it.
Well, there were definitely Warburgs on both sides.
Yeah.
American side.
And it's kind of the idea that if the Jews are involved, and they're involved in enough numbers, they're going to have it their way. For to think that they're not is naive and stupid. I mean, we need to just accept that they got it their way.
They don't even have to be a majority to get their way either. If you have a loud and pushy minority, mm-hmm. Demanding something, they're likely to get it if everybody else is ambivalent.
And then another thing, the Jews are busy all during the war, knowing that the war is going to come to an end. They might even know when. Who knows? They're running the whole thing. And so they're preparing what they want to happen afterwards. So they've already got all these plans and stuff in mind and know what they want to push through, where the others are still in a state of kind of confusion, some people thinking that it's still open, others just caught up in their own greed and nationalisms and so on. And they're just... So the Jews were better prepared to get their way than anybody else.
Of course.
Yeah.
Because they were thinking that way.
Yeah, they had it all thought out.
There are any number of lines of investigation Mr. Brisbane might enter. And in any one of them, his knowledge of his country and of its relation to this particular question would be greatly enlarged. Does Mr. Brisbane know who owns Alaska? He may have been under the impression, in common with the rest of us until we learned better, that it was owned by the United States. No, it is owned by the same people who are coming rapidly to own the United States.
Well, now, I looked up Alaska. Well, I really couldn't find anything to support what they're intimating here, that it's owned by the Jews. I mean, do you have any idea?
Not sure. I think you'd have to look into probably mining,
mm-hmm.
something like that.
Yeah, they probably know a lot business-wise. It was just that they were very, dominant in the business that was going on there. The United States just owns, the Alaskan. The people of Alaska just own a small part of that. Mostly it's owned by the United States. What's called public land or something like that.
Yeah. Is Mr. Brisbane, from the vantage point afforded by his position in national journalism, even dimly aware that there are elements in our industrial unrest which neither capital nor labor accurately define? Has he ever caught a glimpse of another power which is neither labor nor capital in the productive sense, whose purpose and interest it is to keep labor and capital as far apart as possible, now by provoking labor, now by provoking capital? In his study of the industrial situation and its perfectly baffling mystery, Mr. Brisbane must have caught a flash of something behind this backmost scene. The backmost scene. It would be good journalistic enterprise to find out what it is. Okay, he's implying something there about international finance and its relation to labor unrest.
Mm-hmm.
Which is something that was well commented by National Socialists in the 1920s. The fact that the Social Democrats seemed to be very chummy with international finance.
Yeah, I'm sure that Ford and his associates had read, actually this is only 1920. Well, they had been reading some of this, so this was already in progress, these ideas about labor and capital.
Well, we already know that the big labor union leaders were Jews, at least some of them. Samuel
yes.
Gompers, and there was another one.
Yeah, we talked about that last week. They're all, everybody mentioned was a Jew.
Yeah.
Well, Jews are always, they've always gone into labor agitation and running, trying to run the labor. At least back then they did. Well, they've kind of destroyed labor unions. First they built them up, then they destroyed them.
Yeah. The main thrust of National Socialism was really the reconciliation of the worker with the industrialist.
Thank you. I like that. I believe that too.
Yeah. Has Mr. Brisbane ever printed the names of the men who control the sugar supply of the United States? Does he know them? Would he like to know them? Mm. Has he ever looked into the woolen situation in this country from the change of ownership in cotton lands and the deliberate sabotage of cotton production by banking threats right on through to the change in the price of cloth and clothing? And has he ever noted the names of the men he found on that piece of investigation? Would he like to know how it is done and who does it? Mr. Brisbane could find all these things and give them to the public by using his efficient staff of investigators and writers on this question. Whether Mr. Brisbane would feel free to do this, he himself best knows. There may be reasons why he would not. Private reasons. Prudential reasons.
Yeah, you see, now Ford would like some of these very influential people in the media to get on the right side.
Yeah.
But they're not doing it. You know, Ford was a very influential man, but even so, was no match, really, with his little Dearborn Independent, even with all his money, to this concentrated network of media communication. So, you know, media, that's really where they got in and how they, you know, banking, yes, but media is how they keep everybody believing things that they shouldn't believe.
That's where the power is in a country that's governed by voting.
Yes.
Because the people can only vote based on what they know. And who's the middleman for what they know? It's the mass media.
Mm-hmm. Good.
However that may be, there are no reasons why he should not make a complete study of the question. A real study, not a superficial glance at it with an eye to its news value. And arrive at his own considered conclusion. There would be no intolerance about that. No, we don't want to be intolerant. That's the point. As it is now, Mr. Brisbane is not qualified to take a stand on either side of the question. He simply brushes it aside as troublesome, as the old planters used to brush aside the anti-slavery moralists. And for that reason, the recent defense of the Jew is not a defense at all. It is more like a bid for favor.
That's a dig, kind of. Well, it's truth. Yeah. I mean, it's really, that's a quite a good statement. Honest.
I wonder if this was simply written enough for Mr. Brisbane to understand.
If he even read it. I imagine he did.
Probably, yeah.
Yeah.
Mr. Brisbane's chief aversion, apparently, is toward what he calls race prejudice and race hatred. Of course, if any man should fear that the study of an economic situation would plunge him into these serious aberrations of mind, he should be advised to avoid that line of study. There is something wrong either with the investigation or with the investigator when prejudice and hatred are the result. It is a mighty poor excuse, however, for an intelligent man to put forward either on his own behalf or on behalf of those whose minds he has had the privilege of molding over a course of years. Prejudice and hatred are the very conditions which a scientific study of the Jewish question will forestall and prevent. We prejudge what we do not know, and we hate what we do not understand. The study of the Jewish question will bring knowledge and insight, and not to the Gentile only, but also to the Jew.
There goes that hopefulness again.
Yeah, what hope? You think you can reason with Jews? Okay, we'll try. The Jew needs this as much, even more than the Gentile. For if the Jew can be made to see, understand, and deal with certain matters, then a large part of the question vanishes in the solution of ideal common sense. Awaking the Gentile to the facts about the Jew is only part of the work. Awaking the Jew to the facts about the question is an indispensable part. The big initial victory to be achieved is to transform Gentiles from being mere attackers and to transform Jews from being mere defenders. Both of them special pleaders for partisan views, and to turn them both into investigators. The investigation will show both Gentile and Jew at fault, and the road will then be clear for wisdom to work out a result, if there should, perchance, be that much wisdom left in the race. In the human race, obviously.
Do you think that's what he means there?
Yeah.
He means that much wisdom left in the white...
In the human race, probably, is what he means.
Probably. Probably is.
Yeah. There is a... By the way, this sounds very much like revisionism to me. You know, trying to make reason prevail.
With people who have no interest in it. Absolutely none. You know, but you have to, if you're going to be a reasonable person yourself and not appear to be a hater or a prejudge, you have to say, well, these people can, you know, we have to come to an agreement. We can come to a gentlemanly agreement. We can come to a reasonable agreement. We can work this thing out. But it never happens. It can't happen. I wouldn't waste a minute with it myself.
You get your Deborah Lipstadt's and Monsieur Bensoussan's coming along and saying, no, we must not discuss this. Must not debate.
Yeah. Right. And they do. And they have all these organizations. Well, you know, maybe we'll have time to mention some of that at the end.
Yeah. There is a serious snare in all this plea for tolerance. Tolerance is first a tolerance of the truth. Tolerance is urged today for the sake of suppression. There can be no tolerance until there is first a full understanding of what is tolerated. Ignorance, suppression, silence, collusion, these are not tolerance. I thought that was a great statement.
Yes, I was going to say too, but I didn't. But yeah, that all is very good.
That's like a definition of political correctness right there.
Yes, right. Let's repeat that. So just stay ignorant, suppress things, be quiet, shut your mouth, or go along, collude with the powerful ones, collude with the Jews. This is what's called tolerance. These are the forms of tolerance that we know.
So-called.
Yeah, so-called.
The Jew never has been really tolerated in the higher sense because he has never been understood.
Yeah, we don't understand how evil he is.
Well, see, you're one of those bad people.
Yeah, I know. Well, I shouldn't use the word evil. I should say, should come up with a different word, but similar.
Ford's idea is that...
Transigent.
If you understand them, you're not really going to hate them.
It's not true, though. When you understand them, then you do see that they're not... They don't fit in society.
Yeah. You could be pressed to the limit of your wits and the limit of your tolerance while perfectly understanding what's going on. That's certainly possible.
Mm-hmm.
Mr. Brisbane does not assist the understanding of this people by reading a simply written book and flinging a few Jewish names about in a sea of type.
There's that simply written again. And
yeah.
It's in quotes. That's the second time he's referred
to
that.
He owes it to his own mind to get into the question whether he makes newspaper use of his discoveries or not. Yeah, stop being such a nitwit, Brisbane. Learn something for once. Mm-hmm. As to the newspaper angle, it is impossible to report the world even superficially without coming everywhere against the fact of the Jews. And the press gets around to that fact by referring to them as Russians, Letts, Germans, and Englishmen.
That's good, too.
Yeah, this mask of names is one of the most confusing elements in the whole program.
Problem.
And, of course, that also occurs on the individual level, where you have Jews that hide their ethnicity.
Right.
Oh, my family was from Russia.
Yeah.
Sure.
Somewhere I read, where was that? Was it here? Or that all our Jews are from Poland. I think it was the Ford who said that. And maybe it's in this, or maybe it's in that other thing, something else I read. But all our Jews are... Oh, no, that was a German who said that. All our Jews are from Poland. Oh, I read something by a German.
That's an overstatement, but they had a large number of Polish Jews at one point.
Yeah.
That had to be deported.
Well, the Polish Jews are all supposedly from Russia. You know, the Polish Jews are really Russian Jews. And then when they come to Germany... they're still Polish and Russian Jews, but they call themselves Germans. But there were some German Jews there, I guess, early on. I'm not.
Yeah, some Jews have been in Germany for a long, long time.
Yeah.
But not huge numbers.
Yeah, they were over in the western part.
You know, that Meyer Amschel Rothschild, he lived in Germany.
Yeah, that's right. How he got there, I don't know.
Mr. Brisbane should study this question. Actually, you know, the Jews, I'm not sure about when it happened, but the reason why Jews spoke Yiddish in Eastern Europe is because they had congregated in southern Germany at one point, down in Bavaria or thereabouts.
So they say, or there has to be
German
some
language.
Kind of, yeah, they had to get it somehow, didn't they? It's all very difficult to follow.
And they radiated out into Eastern Europe in modern times, I believe.
Well, maybe there were some there from that had that Yiddish, and then they taught it to all the rest that they associated with in the East and in Russia.
Well, one reason for Jews to use some kind of German language is that also the Germans were very big in trade. You know, there was the Hanseatic League.
Yeah. Okay.
Mr. Brisbane should study this question for the light such a study would throw on other matters with which he is concerned. It would be a help to that study if, from time to time, he he would publish some of his findings because such publication would put him in touch with a phase of Judaism which mere complimentary editorials could not. He's saying if Brisbane takes the if he ever dares to say anything critical of the Jews in one of his editorials, he'll find out something.
Oh, well, yeah, I think he's now going on the kind of the attack. I mean, he's not just letting Brisbane tear into him in this editorial of his. He's trying to turn it back on Brisbane.
Yeah,
if Brisbane would do his job properly, he might teach us something. But
yeah,
what he's done,
and he might learn something too.
Thing. Yeah, right. That's
no
what
doubt.
This whole thing is about.
No doubt Mr. Brisbane has been deluged by communications which praised him for what he has written. The real eye-opener would come if he could get several bushels of the other kind. Nothing that has ever come to him could compare with what would come to him if he should publish even one of the facts he could discover by an independent investigation. Having written about the Jews, Mr. Brisbane will probably have a readier eye henceforth for other men's pronouncements on the same subject. In his casual reading, he will find more references to the Jew than he has ever noticed before. Some of them will probably appear in isolated sentences and paragraphs of his own papers. Sooner or later, every competent investigator and every honest writer strikes a trail that leads toward Jewish power in the world. The Dearborn Independent is only doing with system and detail what other publications have done or are doing piecemeal.
Hmm. They're standing up for themselves.
Wait a second here. Uh-oh. You want to read a little bit? I've lost my page. I hit the wrong button.
Okay. This is the last paragraph, listeners. There is a real fear of the Jew upon the publicity sources of the United States. No kidding. A fear which is felt and which ought to be analyzed. Unless it is a very great mistake, Mr. Brisbane himself has felt this fear, though it is quite possible he has not scrutinized it. It is not the fear of doing injustice to a race of people. All of us ought to have that honorable fear. It is the fear of doing anything at all with reference to them except unstintingly praising them. An independent investigation would convince Mr. Brisbane that a considerable modification of praise in favor of discriminate criticism is a course that is pressing upon American journalism. And that's the conclusion. This was, as I said earlier, was in the Dearborn Independent on the issue of July 3rd, 1920. In response to this, so these last two chapters, they wrote in response to articles in magazines, or the first one was a magazine, the second one was this very big, big, big newspaper that had 20, where the what was in there as a readership of 20 million. Very interesting. And I'm going to put, are you back yet?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm going to put the, I've got some little notes here afterwards. Rabbi, oh, okay. I'm going to put a link to Brisbane's editorial on the program page. And, I could say, we got a few minutes. I could say a little bit about it. This link takes you to the Canadian Jewish Chronicle of July 2nd, and the whole paper's in there. It's one of those things on Google that you have to look at only part of it at a time, but it's you can read the whole thing. And what I have to open my page up to function with this thing. Okay, what it starts out with Brisbane saying prejudice and race hatred are dying, but slowly. Race hatred resulting in murder among ignorant peasants of Eastern Europe does not surprise you. But when race hatred taking a new lease of life appears in the Far West in a weekly newspaper owned by Henry Ford, one of the most useful citizens in this country, you are surprised. So it goes on, you know, attacking Ford, but also praising the Jewish people for all, giving Jews credit for all kinds of wonderful contributions to mankind, starting out, you know, with saying they were the Phoenicians, and you know, it just goes on like that for a couple of pages. And let's see, maybe I should go to the end of it and see what he says, how he ends
it. There was one thing there that you could dispute, where he says that Jews never compare Jews to Phoenicians, unless it's for Gentile consumption. There's a famous statement that Freud made, which Peter Schenk used to quote all the time, or at least in one of his shows, what he saw himself as a Hannibal, you know, bringing...
Who did?
Freud. He saw himself as some kind of a Hannibal conquering Europe.
Ugh.
Something to that effect. So that was Freud saying that, and he was certainly a Jew. But maybe that was for Gentile consumption. I don't know.
Well, yeah, you don't know. Let's see what he says.
But you know, it could be kind of a generic comparison rather than meaning to imply that Phoenicians are similar to Jews.
Well, he just goes on and on through this whole thing of giving Jews credit for just about every area of accomplishment that there is, you know, in prize fighting and everything. You know, I mean, they're just they just got these great examples. And then he says, the simply written book that he recommended to Ford to read was this Jacobs book by a man named Jacobs, something about the history of history of Jews or something like that. And then he says hatred. He ends this by saying it that people should buy and read this book. It gives facts, a truthful review of history. And he says hatred of Jews and ignorance concerning them that marked the Middle Ages disgrace any man in this age and are especially unworthy of such a man as Henry Ford. Occasionally, this writer receives a letter from a colored preacher in the South who says earnestly that the earth is really not round, but flat, and the Reverend, quote, can prove it. He says he is not asked to prove it. The rotundity of the earth is no longer discussed. So I guess what he means by that, the question about the Jews also is already settled, and they're fine folks, and we don't need to discuss it. Something.
And he also gives them a lot of credit for the fact that they make money, as if that were a mark of merit in itself.
Oh, yeah, success. Success, success. It's all about success.
Yeah, that's what the National Socialists and what Thomas Carlyle called mammonism.
Yes. Okay. And people connect that with the Jews. It certainly is not Christian. And not that, you know, I'm going to be promoting Christianity all the time, but it's, you know, there's a big divide between the two. I find it difficult to say that Christianity is Jewish. But I didn't mean to end on that note particularly.
Well, there are a lot of Greek ideas in Christianity. It's not all Jewish, actually.
Right. So, well, I do hope that people can go and read this editorial by Brisbane if they want to. So thanks again, everyone, for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode.
I'm breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.